You're listening to WGXC Acra, Hudson, Catskill.
Name, Patty Boom. Host of Vinyl Freedom. Where? WGXC, when? Every first and third Tuesday from 12:10 to 2 p.m. What? Streaming online at WGXC.org. What? Tune in for a genre shakedown. All kinds of choice cuts of wax for you and yours to listen to. Dig it.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by Crisafulli Brothers Plumbing, Heating, Cooling, and Electrical. Upstate New York's home services company since 1993. Red Carpet Service and Solutions. For more information, visit CRISBRO.com.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Susanna Bradley of Tivoli, New York. WGXC supporters care deeply about Creative Community Radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You too can become a monthly supporter by going to WGXC.org/donate and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
Take your Wellingtons off, children, and Mammy will tell you a pleasant story.
Good evening. It's Kevin Factor here with Foraging Ahead. Tonight on Foraging Ahead, Matt Cartsonis. Matt is a multi-instrumentalist, a studio musician, and producer and editor and engineer of audiobooks. Just a remarkable, talented human being. He has more chutzpah than I've ever seen any man or woman, but his amiable persona and casual self-effacing style mask boundless talent, hard work, discipline, and a passion for music. He describes his relationship to music, which is lifelong, as an addiction. We should all have such fruitful dependencies. Every time I talk with Matt, I get a musical history lesson. So get ready to play name drop bingo and hear about the remarkable, versatile Matt Cartsonis. A pleasure and a privilege to count him among my friends and guests at Foraging Ahead. Matt Cartsonis.
When did you decide that you wanted to make a life in music?
That is a very good question for which I have no real solid answer. All I know is that it happened. I was going to do other things. And, you know, if you look at music as an addiction, it took over and I did not have rehab. So instead of becoming a marine biologist, which I really wanted to do, I had been playing since I was, my friend Tom back in Arizona and I started playing together when we were 15. And then we went straight into clubs and that was really fun. It's like, oh, this is a living, potentially a living.
Right.
It's not like working. It's like doing what we do, but getting paid. And at that point, you know, in high school, $15 a week seemed like a lot. It was just something that came to both of us really easily, and yeah, I went to school for, you know, basically neurophysiology, and thought about going to graduate school or maybe becoming a doctor.
Medical school, yeah.
And the second I graduated, I went back to Arizona and started playing in honky tonk bands, and
well, your parents must have been relieved.
They I'm not sure what they thought.
Really?
Yeah.
It's like, here's my, you know, you were going to be a doctor.
And there was never any pressure there.
In fact, very good.
My mom, who was basically a red diaper baby from New Jersey,
right.
She was a humongous Pete Seeger fan.
And
I ended up going to famous women's college in Poughkeepsie, which is right next to the organization Clearwater.
Right.
Founded by Pete Seeger and some of his red diapery friends. And
mm-hmm.
I got involved with that. That was actually one of the reasons why I went to Bassett.
Oh, I did not know that.
Yeah, it was any number of... Yeah, I was throwing things out. I was not a very good high school student. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I was like a C student. A lot of...
How did you get into Vassar?
Vassar, I wrote a 10-page essay for one.
Oh, really?
Get a chance. That's the sort of things almost immediately get you disqualified. And I sent him a cassette.
Oh?
And then I started, while I was waiting, I sent out a sort of a bunch of applications. And it came down to, is he going to go to Vassar or Cornell? An interview with the Vassar person.
Mm-hmm.
It was awesome. And if I get in, which I don't think is very likely, I'm never going to be able to pay for this. So I went in, to make a long story short, got a job on a sword fishing boat out of Key West,
right.
Thinking that that would make a bunch of money, which it didn't. But it also created, once I found that, I got that job after I found out I'd been accepted, but mm-hmm. before I found out, financial aid. And it really helped develop a relationship with the financial aid people.
So you went back, you graduated Vassar.
And then I went directly back.
You went back to Arizona, and you went right back to the bars playing music.
Yeah, playing music with a sort of a what you would have called progressive country back in the day. And we're mostly focused around Phoenix, but we would... 3 times a year, go up to Jackson Hole, play at this great place called Million Dollar Cowboy Bar, and then it hit all sorts of places around there. So we were sort of a Western country scene thing.
And uh-huh.
We had a great lead guitar player. I was playing piano and other stuff. And it was really, really fun and put off reality in a good way for quite a while. Then I got involved with the Arizona Commission for the Arts, and I did residencies outside of, like, on the Apache Reservation.
Oh, wow.
Various places, small towns, doing folk music in schools. And that was satisfying, but then, the Bush 1 administration came in, and the funding just got gutted.
Oh.
We had a wake for all of our programs, and what are we going to do next? They said California is the place you ought to be.
Oh, so because Pete Seeger famously made the rounds of elementary schools when he was blacklisted and
that was his career alive
and exposed an entire generation of Americans to his music and
farming.
Yeah. And my dad was a huge, huge fan. One of the only things my dad ever kept of correspondence was he got a letter from Pete Seeger that he had written to Pete when my dad was in the Army and was teaching himself the 5-string banjo from Pete's book. And Pete sent him a little handwritten note of encouragement with a little banjo on it.
Yeah, the banjo, that is the red banjo of courage. It's funny because I had the same experience.
Yeah.
I was down in Key West and I was working with, we called them juvenile delinquents back then. It was a residential facility for kids who showed promise from the big state school up in, Gatorland, way up north. They sent them down to Key West to learn, like, small engine repair and get their GEDs. And I was a counselor, but I had all these instruments. But I had all these instruments with me, and I said, "What is a good way to? How do we?" The kids really responded to music as they do. And we were on this decommissioned Navy base, the Truman Annex, just down from Truman's little White House, which I used to break into and play his piano.
Uh-huh.
Don't tell. But there were all these 55-gallon drums that the Navy had left. Who knows what was in them? Yikes. And I had driven across the country to get to Key West in my old Dodge Dart. And in the trunk, I had this book, The Steel Drums of Kim Lloyd Wong, written by Pete Seeger.
Uh-huh.
And in the back of it, it had instructions on how to make the steel drum.
Oh.
What better way to pound out, you know,
your anger and trauma and frustration than...
Yeah, so keep... I had a big old mallet and, right. and a hacksaw, and we made a steel drum, and it worked.
Really?
Yeah, so I had also traveled across the country, and in the same trunk was my stack of Sing Out magazines. From the 70s. And in one of them, Pete had this column called Johnny Appleseed Jr. And in one of them, what was he thinking? What was he thinking? He published his mailing address. And so I wrote to him, now, Pete, Mr. Seeger, sir, you know, we just made the steel drum and work, but it doesn't look like the fancy ones that they use down at Sunset Pier in Key West. I could not believe that.
Yeah.
2 weeks later, I got...
Holy cow.
Yeah,
yeah.
The same thing. Well, you know, the technology has come a long time since their invention in Trinidad, which is when I wrote the book. So you might approach one of these players and find where they obtained it and find go to the creator and ask them how it might have been done. That could be good. And you say you're coming up to Poughkeepsie. Well, be sure to drop in.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And, sadly, that letter's been eaten by mice, but it had the same bag.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I was huge. And I ended up meeting him very shortly after getting up to that.
Oh, wow. And... But you were also, I mean, you were well-versed. You'd been doing folk music. You'd been doing Texas swing, Western swing. You've been...
Yeah, I had been through sort of, I don't know if you call it, boot camp situation.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, starting the first band I was in with my friend Tom.
Sure.
We played at a club called Crazy Eds in Phoenix. Mm. It had a Dixieland band. And the guy who hired us for those $15 was their bass player and sort of personality, a guy named Igor. Hi, Igor. Oh, Igor. And, but the trumpet player in that band was a guy named George Rock, who had come to Phoenix to retire or other things, but he was Spike Jones's trumpet player forever.
Yes. Spike Jones from the novelty songs and the T for Two and
you always heard the one you love.
You always heard, yeah.
And the Laughing Record from the 40s. Have you ever heard that one?
I've heard. My dad was a big fan of
the trumpet plays Flight of the Bumblebee.
Yeah, yeah. All right.
That messes up.
Yeah.
Or sneezes, and then everybody in the band just starts laughing. It's just laughing all the way through, and by the end of it, you're dying also.
That's
and
cool.
That's George Rock on the trumpet. And
oh, wow.
The band, you know?
That's hilarious.
So it was influences of that, a broad swath of influences. I mean, I did not grow up with country music in the house, except on the Saturdays that, you know, start with that good old country music from the Grand Ole Opry, into the Buck Owens Ranch Show, which is now on YouTube, and everybody should see it because Don Rich is on that stuff, and it's just ridiculous.
The Buck Owens Ranch Show.
Yeah, please.
Check it out. Yeah. All right, cool.
And then after that would be Hee Haw.
Hee Haw. Yeah, we weren't allowed to watch Hee Haw.
Oh, really?
Well, because it replaced the Smothers Brothers.
Oh.
Right, so that was a political decision not to watch Hee Haw. And that was during, I mean, an era on television where all of a sudden there were all of these country southern themed shows, you know, aimed at sort of rehabilitating the and revising the southern narrative, mm-hmm. right? So you get Hee Haw, Petticoat Junction, Beverly Hillbillies, Green Acres. It was known as an era in television.
You know, that is something that my upbringing, because I grew up basically in a Mayberry-ish sort of situation.
Yeah. Well, we're talking in a Mayberry right now.
Yeah. But we had three towns. We had a white town, a largely Mexican-American town, and a largely black town.
Oh, yeah.
And we, and not to mention labor camps, no, not prison.
Okay.
We got those now. But
yeah.
But Camp 52 was just down the street, and that's where a lot of the agricultural workers and seasonal workers, some permanent, lived. And if they got out of that box, they would move to Goodyear, which was a more settled place. But they did not make it to Litchfield Park, where I grew up. My dad was a city planner for it. He had a vested sort of interest, but we were integral to it familially. However, the country club in the town was exclusive. No Jews. I forget when, maybe the late 60s or early 70s.
Wow.
And which was something that continues to trouble me.
What, that there were no Jews allowed in the country club?
Yeah, I mean, that we grew up in a number of reasons. You know, growing up in that environment, not really knowing it. I mean, I got beat up.
Really?
For being a Christ killer.
Really?
The first time when I was in third grade, and I had no idea what that meant.
Oh, wow.
So, and music was, just to bring it back, music was kind of a refuge from
sure.
the stupidity around us.
So funding got cut for
the Arizona
Commissioner of the Arts to enrich the lives of children.
Yeah.
Because why should that be my responsibility, right? If you want to enrich a child,
their parents.
What?
That's their parents' job.
That's their parents' job, right? And if they don't want to enrich them, then that's their business. So then you moved to L.A. You decided that was at that moment you were like, this is, I'm going to.
I was going to make a change of some kind. I was actually visiting New York City with somebody you know who might just be downstairs. Tim Seeger, my college roommate.
Right.
And I was thinking about moving to New York because I knew a lot of people because of school.
Mm-hmm.
My sister called me up from Los Angeles. She's a movie producer.
Mm.
Dude across the street from me just died. And his apartment's open, it's rent controlled, and if you don't take it, I will kill you. And she is a person of her word. And so out of fear, I adapted my plans very quickly. But it also made sense. I mean, you know, our generation, if I may use that term loosely, you know, we had record jackets, and we read the...
Yeah, yeah, liner notes, you read the liner notes, yeah.
Yeah, I figured... Okay, the musical community in Arizona is have explored that, and it's becoming something other than what it used to be, and you know, a lot of people are moving in, and who knows, you know, what one can do there, or what I could do there beyond what I had already done. That sounds kind of highfalutin, and I don't mean it that way. It's just like I didn't know what to do. So I figured, well, there's this high-level community of musicians, you know, they're on all these record jackets. Maybe I could meet them. Maybe I could even play with them, and maybe I could become a part of that community. And, that was a harsh lesson. I ended up meeting a lot of
them. Oh?
Name drop?
Yeah, name drop.
Oh, let's see. The main hero, he doesn't know it, or maybe he does. He was my long-distance mentor. It was Ryan Cooter.
Oh, wow.
And, I first got introduced to him on Arlo Death Ray Records. So if take a step back, I will tell you, Arlo was the reason I actually got super injected with the possibility of actually being a musician.
Really? How'd that...
I went to see him when I was 13.
Oh, wow.
And, I had just seen my first concert, which was Elton John Goodbye Yellow Brick Road.
Right.
That was pretty great. There were only 3,500 people there. He wasn't huge yet.
Mm.
But then a month later, we went and saw Arlo at Grady Gamage in Tempe. And it was just him and his guitar. And he was just great. He was hilarious. His patter was natural and fun. Whoa, people can do this.
Mm.
And I think I want to try to do this. Mm. And that was the motivation. So I got a bunch of his records and saw that people played on it, which is just basically an almanac of the Los Angeles roots music scene of the early to mid 70s. People like Clarence White, Rye, Lee Sklar on the bass, or Chris Etheridge, all the Little Feet guys, Van Dyke Parks. So many of them. And wow, I bet they all get together and play together for fun. That was not true.
No.
but it was a motivation for going out there. And I did manage to, over time, get as close to that scene as, which was waning,
mm.
as was possible. And those guys are getting pretty old.
Mm.
But I managed to have some interesting experiences in those regards as sort of a zealot or a fly on the wall or whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all, developmentally a great adventure, and I learned a lot, and, it's tough to put, in my book of memories. I'm not sure how useful it is in the greater picture, but then again, what is life anyway? Okay,
so when was it that you first, your first LA gig or your first session, or when you started making a living playing music in LA? Because you moved out to LA, you basically didn't have a job, right?
What I was doing was flying back to Phoenix to play casuals in a cowboy hat. And an Arizona flag.
What's a casual?
It's where Deloitte Touche or United Health comes to Scottsdale for a convention. They want to eat steaks, and you're the.
I hear some cowboy music.
Yeah.
Huh.
And did that with my friends. It actually funded my move to Los Angeles, and I did that for a while. And then, it's okay. It's tough because. When I first moved out there, I really wasn't doing much musically. I was shocked. I'd never lived in a big city before.
Mm.
And, just so green and,
right.
and wet behind the ears. I had a friend from going up and back and forth to Jackson Hole. And this is one of those, it's a small world things. A fellow named John Cook, who... has moved along to the greater beyond at this point, or as of now, a few years ago. But John was part of the Cambridge folk scene back in the early 60s. And he was also Janis Joplin's road manager for the extent of her career. He found her when she died, etc. And in a small world situation, Kim Seeger, called your mates, Uncle George... worked with John, with Janis Joplin. It's just so true. When I told John that I was moving to, and he's a Western novelist and musician, and among other things, the son of Alistair.
What?
Yeah.
Wow.
But very much his own dude.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, oh, you're moving. And the reason I do the Pete Seeger voice is he sounded kind of like him. You're going to Los Angeles. I'll have to introduce you to my friends. John Cook took me to a party.
Okay? Yeah.
I went to this party. we'll bring out guitars. And we start playing. And there's this guy there, a fellow named Peter Lawrence. He said, oh, would you play guitar at my wedding? He's getting married. He wanted crank to 11 electric guitar version of the wedding march on slide guitar. I want it to be a combination. If I could have met Jimi Hendrix. As the sun's going down over Palos Verdes. And I did that, and it was really fun.
Mm-hmm.
And afterwards, he says, I like the way you think. You should write for me. Write for you? He turns out he's a cartoon producer or a director. He directed Thundercats.
Oh, yeah, Thundercats. Yeah.
And a bunch of other stuff. And he and I became really good friends. He lived down in Columbia now. But I ended up writing cartoons with him. But I think I can say that may have been my first actual gig in Los Angeles.
Was playing
Jimi Hendrix meets Ry Cooder slide guitar at sunset
at the wedding march for and it's funny. And then because of that you got a job writing Thundercats.
Well, it was post Thundercats.
Oh, post Thundercats. So he was on
it was a
he's just riding that Thundercat high. Yeah.
Yeah. And we ended up working on Johnny Quest together. I did a lot of that stuff for about 3 years until this was not what I came to town for. What else we could do? But then music started happening. Started going to the sort of songwriter clubs around Los Angeles and sitting in with people. And it's funny that when you do that, people see you and then they ask you to do other stuff. Well, little by little, so I started playing sort of by default with a fellow named Phil Covey, who has a couple of records. He was on Interscope, and we're still pals. And his bass player played with a fellow named Peter Himmel, who is a fabulous singer, songwriter, and performer who is still at it and has roots in the Woodstock area. And we had a blast playing together.
Where did you play? What did you play?
Oh, I played multi-instrumental stuff. Guitar, banjo, a lot of slides, mandolin, sandolin, and stuff like that. But that led to, after that sort of organically went its own way, I became really good buddies with the guys in his band, a fellow named Andy Cannon, who's not just a great accountant, but the best drummer in town. Hear that, Andy? Tune in. Somebody tell Andy to tune in. And Andy got this call from a manager friend. Andy, like Peter, they were all from Minnesota. They came out to Los Angeles together.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to get things.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. And one of their Minnesota music management connections called Andy and said, Warren Zevon's looking for a band. And, somebody along the way, the thing about Himmelman's band is you got to be really spontaneous. You never know what direction he's going to be going. And he's really fun, and you have to be on your toes. And Zevon was looking for a band that could do that. And he called up and said, got this call. I don't know what I think, but here's what we're going to do. Yeah, it doesn't matter if we get it or not. We're going to try. And we're going to call Sheldon. You're going to play the drums. I'm going to play guitar. We're going to learn the tunes, find out what the tunes are. We're going to learn them. And at least we'll meet Warren Zevon.
Yeah.
And we did it. And he hired us like that.
Really?
Yeah. And we had a fabulous tour around the Western regions, and it was just a blast. I think Los Angeles, at best, is a five-year town, meaning you got to be there for at least 5 years before things start happening for you, unless you've got some kind of foothold or rich uncle. But the Zeelon thing, you know, he was not at the high point of his commercial career. He was attempting to rejuvenate it.
Mm-hmm.
It was working. But they didn't have money for a full band tour the next year. So it just became him and me.
You and Warren Zevon.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And so we did, and we didn't do much, but because he suddenly was diagnosed with mesothelioma and was no longer with us.
Right.
Which is a great disappointment to me, because we had a good thing going.
Yeah.
And I do miss it.
Hmm.
But
so how many years did you play with him?
Just two.
Two years? Yeah.
Yeah. But they were a big 2 years.
I can imagine. I can imagine. I mean, I'm sure you're going to say this for your memoir, but what surprised you about getting to know him? That,
you know, I don't know. I think that I have a sort of cultivated shield of something that, you know, there weren't really any surprises. It was just kind of roll with it. But one thing I can tell you is that he was not like anybody I ever knew. He had a cultivated urbanity.
Really?
Which was something, considering he grew up in Fresno.
Mm-hmm.
But he was a complete autodidact. He had taught himself all sorts of stuff. He was a prodigy.
Mm.
He studied with Igor Stravinsky, for crying out loud,
when mm-hmm.
he came to Los Angeles. As a kid, they recognized him as a talent. Said, oh, you should know Mr. Stravinsky. Got together and stuff. It's all in his biographies. But he was also, I mean, he was really complicated. And I don't know exactly what happened to him developmentally, but his struggles with alcohol and drugs
sure.
are fairly legendary.
Mm.
And also his recovery, which he did, which he white knuckled largely.
Really? Wow.
I remember going over to his house, his apartment. He lived in this little apartment
in
West Hollywood that was just, it looked like the stacks in your university library. It was just jammed with books. The reader, but up in the cupboard behind the kitchen was an open cabinet with a bottle of Stoli with the seal crack. Mm-hmm. And it was the same thing when we were on the bus. You know, he left his toiletries kit open. He had an open pack of Camel Straights with nothing missing from it.
Really? So wait, he would bring these with him?
Yeah. Well, I never saw him bring the bottle of Stoli with him.
Right. But that's, that bottle of Stoli was in his house.
Yes.
To remind him?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we never actually talked about it. Just
looked. No, you never talked. Yeah.
Looked down and looked at him.
And he nodded.
Yeah.
Yeah? Huh.
So, you know, there was that. The way I have described him to other people is that, you know, sorry to repeat because I think I've said this to you, that some people are crusty on the outside and warm and cuddly on the inside, so
mm-hmm.
creamy.
Mm-hmm.
Warren Zevon was a marble cake.
That's a good analogy. Yeah.
But ultimately, you know, he was just ridiculously inspirationally dedicated to what he did. And you know, he took his work very, very seriously.
Can saw a woman in two, but you won't want to look in the box when I'm through. I can make a love disappear. For my next trick, I'll need a volunteer. And I can pull a rabbit out of a hat. I can pull him out, but I can't put him back. I can make a love disappear. For my next trick, I'll need a volunteer. Step right up for my next trick. I'll need a volunteer. For my next trick, I'll need a volunteer. Step right up for my next trick. I'll need a volunteer. And it's lonely up here when the tricks have been played and the spotlight has faded and the plans that we made have fallen apart. It's lonely as hell, and there's no magic spell for a broken heart. Put me in chains, and I will escape. Better not wait up, 'cause I might be late. Now I can make love disappear. For my next trick, I'll need a volunteer.
You're listening to Foraging Ahead and my conversation with Matt Cartsonis. All the music you hear on tonight's show, is performed by Matt. He did all the instruments. This one here is a cover, of course, Warren Zevon. Remarkable man, Matt Cartsonis, playing everything.
Tricks have been played, and the spotlight has faded, and the plans that we made have fallen apart. It's lonely as hell, and there's no magic spell for a broken heart. I can saw a woman in two, but you won't want to look in the box when I do. I can make a love disappear. For my next trick, I'll need a volunteer.
Sort of simultaneously with Warren, I was playing, I had started playing with John McEwen. I first met McEwen in Phoenix, when I was living in Phoenix. He sat in with me thanks to a drummer friend of mine, a fellow named Merle Briganti, who, if you are a Lungs and Messina fan, and not only is he a great, 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 great drummer, but he's the guy who says, "Pedal the car, long hair." On "Your Mom Can't Dance and Your Daddy Don't Rock and Roll."
Ah. And
he played with them. He played with the Knitting Gritty Dirt Band.
Oh, okay. So McEwen.
He introduced me to McEwen, who came to a gig that my then girlfriend and I had up in Cave Creek, Arizona, a place called Satisfied Frog. It was down the street from the Horny Toad.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny.
And which also, coincidentally, was previously owned by the same guy who owned Crazy Ed's, the place where I started playing when I was 15. Because it's a small world up there. But at the same time that was happening, I was also scoring movie trailers.
So
shops were being developed in that area, too.
Oh, wow.
That's to talk about reinventing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this sort of playing with people was never really, didn't seem like it was ever going to be a moneymaker. And
really? So you didn't, it wasn't like payday for you working with Zevon or John McEwen or?
Never, no.
Really?
It was more like ancillary. Income wise, it dominated time wise,
right.
But
I say that like I'm surprised, but I'm not surprised. No. Because at this point, I know so many ridiculously talented people, and you, who have made a life in music and the arts, and should be obscenely wealthy, should be completely famous, and they're not. But it's the love of what they do. And then I guess you get to a certain... What?
Or addiction. Yeah, it is something that is... I don't know, look, there's a group of people here in Tivoli who get together every weekend for, a very well-established and esteemed hootenanny.
I don't know about esteemed.
It is by me.
Well...
It keeps me coming back.
Well, I...
But, I mean, that's... And what would happen if that weren't there? You'd probably lose your mind. I mean, what's left of it?
Now, you're the kind of person that actually gets along with people, right?
Until I don't.
Well, I don't know. Who doesn't get along with you? I mean, not women. But, like... No, but like,
let's put it this way. Like, I mean, I can be... to do the sort of stuff that I've done, you do have to be sort of... personality compatible with that sort of, though, with
some big egos,
with narcissistic personalities.
Yeah.
And, in a word, I mean, nobody makes it big without really wanting to make it big. Why do they make it big? Why do they want to make it big?
Because they had unhappy family lives growing up.
Something broken in there.
It's interesting.
And I'm not putting myself above that sort of thing,
right?
But I don't have it at the level that I could tolerate the lifestyle, or it's just not motivated to.
Right. So you're broken enough to live happily in the world to a certain extent, but not so broken that you are going to excel to the stratosphere.
Yeah, it's a choice as much as anything.
Well, sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. But
what I was going to say is, so I was playing with McHugh, and that was bluegrass, and he and I did a duo for a long time. Then we started playing with some other guys, John Cable, Les Thompson, and both been in the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, and Les was one of the founders. But I also started working with this fellow, Dandy Parks, who is worth looking up. I mean, he's, along with considering Warren Zevon, there are genius elements to both of those guys. Van Dyke really, in his time at Warner Reprise Records back in the 60s and 70s, created a musical scape that actually was responsible for the liner notes that I read that made me want to move to Los Angeles.
Uh-huh. For people who are not familiar with Van Dyke's work, what are some songs or albums that they would know that he was instrumental in?
He would be mortified on one level and proud on another to make the association with the Beach Boys' Smile album.
All right.
He was very involved with Brian Wilson when they were both in their early 20s, and up through present day, really. Just as songwriting partners. He is an arranger. I first knew of him as a producer and arranger for Arlo Guthrie's records. He did a very big string and horn arrangement for his version of Down in the Valley to Pray back in 1969. But a project that he and I worked on together. Are you familiar with Joanna Newsom?
No.
No. She is...
amazing.
An unusual individual who plays the harp and sings in a very almost rural voice. It's very high and plain, and she plays the harp. And Van Dyke did this strings and harp album that I played banjo and mandolin on a little bit. And watching him do that stuff, and how do you do that stuff? And he did that stuff, and he what I was going to say earlier, all of this music stuff that I don't necessarily consider, it was not a remuneratively rewarding on a high level.
Mm-hmm.
But it was my graduate school.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How I'm using it now, I'm not sure. But it was amazing as a program of learning stuff that I would not otherwise have encountered. So there's that. And you know, through Van Dyke, I got Class of Warmen and played on my Ringo Starr's record.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. We did a lot of crazy stuff. Worked with for a month with Brian Wilson and him.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, in a small room.
Yeah.
That was an education.
Yeah, you have anything you could share from that experience?
Yeah. Brian Wilson is not as crazy as the legend.
Really?
Yeah, and he has empathy. He's a nice fella. And he's getting really, really old now. His wife just died, and he's under care. But then he's struck me as a somewhat frightened, very large young man. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And we had a lot of fun.
Oh, cool. That's really cool. It's good to hear. Yeah. I loved Brian Wilson growing up. Like, I loved the Beach Boys growing up. And I remember, and I saw him at the Bridge concert.
Went up there?
Well, I lived in San Francisco.
Of course you did.
Right? So it wasn't that far. And he was on the bill. He was on the bill with the Who, Neil Young, Pearl Jam, Tom Waits. It was the most insane lineup
I remember when that happened.
Ever seen.
Because he had his band with him, didn't he?
Yeah, yeah. The
Wonderments. The best thing that ever happened to him.
But he only played, you know, came out and played a few songs. And he seemed completely tired. I think this was when he was just reemerging.
So was he kind of robotic?
He was a little bit, he couldn't wait to get into the song, right? So he would say, I remember he introduced the first song. He goes, this is the first song I ever wrote. It's a pretty good song. And he played Surfer Girl, right? And
it sounded great.
But that's the thing with music, the power of music. You're talking about addiction, right? It's understandable, right? Because somebody who is completely terrified, once they slip into a song that they're comfortable with, it's like slipping on a pair of old shoes, you know?
Absolutely.
And my wife, who's a neurologist, would tell you that people with
disorders,
dementia, things like that, forget things. If you tap into that with music and songs, they can do a whole thing. It's how people don't have music as a part of their life in some way is really sad.
We were friends out there, we were just talking about something like this and how, yeah, as the broader American culture is lacking these sort of what's the word I'm looking for?
Communal expressions.
Yeah, generationally developed.
Cultural inheritances, yeah. And things like that. Right. Well, I mean, country music and the music that you do, I mean, there are enough people who know the music that you do that you can, anywhere you go and you find a few people with some acoustic instruments, you'll be able to sit down and go, hey, you know X, you know Y, you know
Z. We have standards, and Hotel California could fit into that context.
Sure, sure. But, I mean, there's a song. Is there if you get a bunch of Americans in a room somewhere, is there a song that, if you start singing, that everybody will know?
Okay, I got a great... This is one of my favorite experiences,
right?
Okay? I was playing with my old girlfriend at the Vancouver Folk Festival in 1988, and I had never done anything like that before.
The Vancouver Folk Festival.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's wild. Were you scared?
Dangerous.
Dangerous.
I wasn't frightened.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was just all of these people were there that I admired. One of them was Jesse Winchester.
Mm.
Are you familiar with him?
No.
worth looking into. He was he's from Memphis originally, but moved to Canada to avoid the draft.
Mm.
Snuck down to Woodstock to record a couple of albums. He was a great songwriter. And he was playing up there. I mean, he was what they called in the 70s songwriter. All this, like Steve Goodman. You know, Lyle Lovett, a lot of his sound, and he has acknowledged this, is Jesse Winchester inspired.
Oh.
And so I'm up there. Are we allowed to talk about flammable substances?
Like marijuana?
Yeah.
And
I wasn't going to say it first.
Yeah.
Okay. So there we were. They always have a party after each night, and the last night is a huge party. And all the performers are there, and it's informal, and it's fun. There's no audience. And so I'm down there seeing all these people. We had musicians from the Nile. Look. We had musicians from the Nile with their little fezes, you know.
Oh, nice.
Weird instruments. And some guy from Brazil, and got Christine Lavin, and it's Ali Parkatoure.
Okay.
And Jesse Winchester shows up.
Mm.
And I walk up. I speak to so don't mean. Would you like to step outside? I said, yes, I would. And he produces a marijuana cigarette and lights it up and shares it.
Oh, very nice.
I'm already bubbling over with just, I can't believe I'm here stuff. And now I'm really, really high.
Mm-hmm.
And he starts on, yes, my life has become a shambles.
Oh.
A woman has left me. Yeah.
Wow, he's sharing.
Yeah, he's sharing.
Yeah.
Sharing highly. And it's, people. Hey, Jesse. No. And so I guess it's time we might all head back into the party. Said, yeah, good idea. And get out there, and everybody, all these people I just described, are in their little corners.
Mm-hmm.
The musicians from the Nile.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Now, the Wild Mystère, the Bulgarian bizarre choir.
Like, yeah.
You know what I
mean? Oh, yeah.
All of them just in different places. And Jesse sits down in a chair, takes out his guitar, tunes it up, and starts playing. Almost Heaven, West Virginia, everybody.
Really?
Everybody, just Ali Farkatoure.
Yeah.
And the Bulgarian singers and the ancient instruments of Serbia and the musicians from the Nile, like their little jingy wingies. You know, it was amazing. And
wow.
I've never seen anything like it before since. I was a little bit, eye rolling about country ranking. It is such a ubiquitous.
Yeah.
And oft repeated to become snarky about it. But not anymore.
Well,
it was the I had, if I had a hammer.
Yeah. No, it was the wagon wheel of its day.
Oh, geez.
I wish I had a banjo string made of golden twine. The only tune I'd pick on it is I wish that girl were mine. Shady Grove, my little love. Shady Grove, my darling. Shady Grove, my little love. Going back to Harlan.
Peaches in the summertime, apples in the fall. If I can't get the boy I love, I won't have none at all.
Shady Grove, my little love. Shady Grove, my darling. Shady Grove, my little love. Going back to Harlan. Some come here to fiddle and dance. Some come here to tarry. Some come here to fiddle and dance. I come here to marry.
Shady Grove, my little love. Shady Grove, my darling. Shady Grove, my little love. Fly around my blue-eyed boy, fly around my daisy, fly.
as red as a blooming rose, and the eyes are the prettiest brown. She's the darling of my heart, prettiest little girl in town.
She grows my little love, she grows my darling, she grows my little love, going back to Harlan. She grows my little love, she grows my darling, she grows my little love, going back to Harlan.
I wish I had a banjo string made of golden twine. The only tune I'd pick on it is Wish That Girl Were Mine.
So let's. I don't want to leave without talking a little bit about your album. Mm. It's called Matt Cartsonis Sings and Plays,
or vice versa.
Yeah, how'd you come up with that?
You know, I had a focus group. to get started, it is really sort of a logical extension of practicing for 5 hours a day in my room in high school. Basically, this was playing 6 hours a day in my room in Santa Monica.
You've been out here and you have nothing to show for yourself, and you've been doing all this stuff for all these years. You better do something.
And so I said,
"Who's that?"
That's me
talking to you.
Yeah, that's
uh-huh. Nice. Is that
voice,
right?
It's not pleasant in her voice, so I had to listen to it. So it shut that. And so I sat down and started doing it, and you know, I'd been playing. There were things about it that were meaningful. For instance, the two Warren Zevon tunes I recorded for my next trip, I'll Need a Volunteer, the day after I learned that he died. And so I sat down with guitar and harmonica and played it, and then built all the other stuff around it. And it sort of exemplifies what I learned from Van Dyke, though I hope he would not blanch or redden at the thought of that. You know, I learned everything I know really about orchestral scoring from him. And you know, granted, these are Cardinals string players; they are keyboard things. But yeah, you know, I tried to add a Van Dykean sort of dramatic scape, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's lonely up here when the chicks have been playing. You know, that stuff. And so you know, it's all stuff that, on some level, had meaning at one time or another in my general calendar.
Yeah, and where can people buy this or download this? Is it, are you going to make it available so you can finally sort of retire from this this meat grinder of a rat race dogfight?
Well,
what?
Audiobooks have helicoptered me out of that.
Oh, thank yeah.
Goodness.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't
so if people hear.
Do you think anybody would like it?
No, but I mean, I got to do this, you know. Where would they be able to hear some of your stuff?
Well, they could reach out to me personally. I'm easy to find if you only know how to spell my name, Matt. New word, CARTSONIS.com.
MattCartsonis.com.
Yeah. And there is email associated with that.
Uh-huh.
I'm pleased to hear from anyone, because it will be a reminder that I, like so many, unlike